Hello, everybody, and welcome to an extended free preview of this month's episode of What a Cartoon Movie, all about Beauty and the Beast. I am one of your hosts for this one, Bob Mackey, and I really like the guest. That's you. And who is here with me today?
Hey, it's Henry Gilbert, the gray stuff enjoyer.
That's right. It's delicious, and you can actually eat it in Florida.
Yes, the dessert version of it. I ate it at Disneyland, too.
Don't go to Florida. Come on, guys. But yes, welcome to another episode of What a Cartoon Movie. And if you're listening to this, that means you're going to hear an extended free preview of our probably 5 or 6 hour discussion of Beauty and the Beast. The history section is 2 hours long alone. You're going to hear about 45 minutes to an hour of that. But if you want to hear the whole thing and get a lot of other stuff on top of that, our entire What a Cartoon Movie catalog, head on over to patreon.com/TalkingSimpsons. Sign up there at the $10 level. We've covered so many other Disney Renaissance movies. In fact, this summer we've just covered The Little Mermaid. Next month we're covering The Rescuers Down Under. We've covered things like Aladdin and The Lion King and even things from the 80s like The Black Cauldron. Yuck!
Yeah.
And The Great Mouse Detective. And yeah, there's just so much happening there. Nearly 4 complete years of a 3 to almost 6 hour long podcast there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and even later ones like Hercules and Hunchback of Notre Dame. Like, we've covered so many great movies and also not Disney movies, if that's your flavor too, like South Park Bigger, Longer, and Uncut, Akira, Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse, Beavis and Butthead Do America, and we have a ton of other cool upcoming ones you can listen to too. Plus, if you sign up at that $10 level to get all the premium ones, you also get all of our $5 benefits, which include monthly episodes of Talking Futurama and Talk King of the Hill, of us covering both of those series super in-depth, just like we do the movies and The Simpsons. And the entire back catalog of previous exclusive podcasts, including us covering every episode of The Critic, every episode of Mission Hill, and our 10 favorite episodes of Batman the Animated Series. There is a ton of stuff you can only access if you are a Patreon subscriber at patreon.com/TalkingSimpsons. So please head to that website or pull up the Patreon app on your phone, perhaps, and check out all the cool stuff you're missing out on that webpage.
That's it for this little intro. Now get ready to hear us talk about Beauty and the Beast while trying not to expectorate. Let's talk about the origins of Beauty and the Beast. So if you want to read the original story, and I did, it's about 14 pages long, very easy to read.
Oh, nice.
Please check out the Penguin Classics edition called Beauty and the Beast, Classic Tales About Animal Brides and Grooms from Around the World, because thousands of years ago, people have wanted to fuck other animal people.
Yes.
It's been a common thing throughout all of humankind. These stories about romances between humans and animal people, going back to, like, Zeus, right?
Yeah. Zeus turned into a goat and fucked a lady, and
I mean, we were always furries, and, I think recently I discovered I'm probably 10% furry, and that's okay.
The boundaries push more and more as you explore, as you explore online spaces.
With sexuality, I think being a furry is a spectrum. I'm, 10%, I think, if I could figure it out. But, yeah, it's been a common thing throughout all of humanity that we love these stories. Beauty and the Beast is just one of, many from tons of different cultures, and this book is packed full of all of them with new translations.
Mm-hmm.
So, Beauty and the Beast, the specific story this movie is based on, it comes from an author called Jean-Marie Le Prince de Beaumont, and it was published in Magazine des Enfants. Magazine des Enfants.
Oh, so magazine for kids?
Children's collection.
Oh, I see.
So basically the same thing.
I got it.
So that version came out in 1756. And just like Pinocchio, the purpose of this story was to encourage good behavior in children, specifically in little girls.
Man, that's just like Little Mermaid. Little Mermaid's original book ending, too, is just like, and you better be good if you want this Little Mermaid to go to heaven.
Yes, it's very didactic, and Disney gets rid of all that crap for the best.
Yeah, well, hey, isn't that how modern capitalism even just cuts out all of the spirituality of any old story? They're
basically
just like, no, we don't need that crap.
Let's secularize everything. So Beaumont, the author of this 14-page story, her story is actually an abridged version of the original.
A girl wrote this?
Yes.
Whoa.
And she ripped off another girl.
Oh, wow. Wow.
So her story is an abridged version of the original novel-length 1740 Beauty and the Beast by author Gabrielle Suzanne de Villeneuve, another woman writer. So her novel comes out in 1740, and then Beaumont's 14-page children's version comes out in 56. And it's no coincidence that Villeneuve dies in 1755.
Oh, well, there you go. Yes. Yeah.
It's finally safe to rip her off.
As soon as the body is cold, they're like, all right, rip that off. That's my story now.
And the Villeneuve version, the novel version, was written for adults. And like I said, she passes away, and then Beaumont has her own version a year later. Technically, Villeneuve is the author of the oldest version of Beauty and the Beast, that version of the story. But Beaumont is the author of the best-known version. And the funny thing about this plagiarism is Disney does not acknowledge Beaumont in the credits. Only in the French version of Beauty and the Beast does it say based on the original story by Beaumont. So that's why if you ask someone like, oh, who wrote this story? Oh, yeah, the Grimm brothers. Who wrote that story? Hans Christian Andersen. Few people could tell you who wrote Beauty and the Beast outside of people in France, probably.
Wow, man. I didn't know that Disney... So, because in some of the extras and promotional materials for Little Mermaid, they were very clear of, like, yeah, from Hans Christian Andersen's original classic. Like, they're much more clear that, I guess, because Hans Christian Andersen is more known in America than I suppose Pinocchio wasn't promoted back then with the name of that author. Either.
Carlo Collodi.
Yes, yeah.
More about Beaumont. So we mentioned Hans Christian Andersen and the Brothers Grimm. They used folk tales to, you know, morally instruct children. That was the purpose of their stories. She did it first.
Oh.
She was the one of the first. She did before them, but because she was a woman, probably, and for other reasons, these stories really never left France, and she wrote a bunch of them, but that's her most notable one.
Okay, wow.
But yeah, if you want to read it, it's 14 pages, and I can go over the differences up next on this podcast. So yeah, like I said before, the story is intended to instruct little children, in this case, little girls, because the main moral lesson of the story is don't worry if your potential husband is smart or pretty. You should be more concerned if he's a good person. It's all about, like, don't be too picky about who you marry. And we'll go into how this story teaches this lesson. So there are some differences in the original story. And before I tell you that, here's a quote that's a thesis statement from the story. Quote, "It is neither good looks nor great wit that makes a woman happy with her husband, but character, virtue, and kindness. And the Beast has all of those good qualities." That's a quote from Belle when she realizes she loves the Beast. Or maybe it's the narrator. I forget.
Huh, interesting. Okay, but... Well, in the movie, he's a real jerk at first, this guy.
Yeah, this story is mainly about Belle getting over her own bullshit and loving an ugly, nice guy.
Okay, yeah. See, man, boy, that almost... It sounds like something a male incel writer would write today, not a woman.
They never pay attention to the nice guys. I mean, it feels like that, but it's written by a woman. Maybe she married a homely guy. Who knows? Like, hey, those homely guys, they're really nice.
It's that meme comic of the handsome guy who compliments the girl, and then when an ugly man says the same thing, she calls the cops.
Yes, that's like the meme version of Beauty and the Beast. So some differences in the story that are not in the movie. Beauty has two sisters and three brothers. The three brothers are barely mentioned in the story, but the two sisters are like evil stepsister types. Mm. So they use that trope in this story.
I can see why you cut them. It's they're just redundant, and you'll just be ripping off the Cinderella's perfect evil stepsisters.
Yeah. These are not notable evil stepsisters. So also, the castle is magic. But sadly, the Beast is the only character inside of it. The different, like, living appliances, that's all Howard Ashman's invention. Not in the story at all.
Okay.
So also, there is no magic rose. There is a rose in the story. So what happens is, similar to the movie, Belle's father, or Beauty's father, rather, goes to the castle and, you know, is shown, like, a nice time, and then he leaves. On the way out in the book, he picks a rose, and that's the final straw.
Right.
But in the movie, the rose is the thing, the timer, basically.
Yeah, it's the ticking clock in the thing. That's, you know, the rose thing, that was it in one of the other adaptations I've seen of Beauty and the Beast, the stealing the rose, which, you know, it might be better to put the fault on Maurice instead of having it just be like, well, the guy, he just didn't want to freeze to death, and you put him in a prison cell?
In the book, I think part of the moral lesson is, like, learn to be a good guest, because Maurice goes to the castle to get in from the cold, but he's also like, hey, while I'm here, I'm going to have three glasses of wine and an entire chicken, and, oh, look, there's hot chocolate waiting for me. I think it's like, well, this guy overstayed his welcome, and that's why he's being punished.
Yeah. You know, kids need to learn that lesson, too. Be a good house guest.
Yeah. And like in the book, Belle is, you know, bookish, she's beautiful. She's selfless. She's honest. She has all the qualities that the author wants little girls to have mm-hmm. growing up. And there's little lines in there where, you know, at the beginning of the story, the father's a merchant, but then they have to move to the countryside. And now they're poor. And the author's like, but Belle didn't complain at all. She didn't mind it at all. But her evil stepsisters are like, this sucks.
Of course. Yeah. Boy, it's so fun to see the lessons, the morals that are being taught through everything.
Yeah, this one is don't complain, I guess. Mm-hmm. So Beauty is the captive of the beast. Seemingly in the story, he is going to kill her father, but she takes his place. And then she starts wandering around the castle and seeing that it's really set up for her. And she's like, maybe he's not going to kill me. And it turns out he's not. He's much more of a mope than a violent jerk. Mm. And the fact that he's very nice outside of these other qualities is the point of the story. Like, the beast is ugly and he's stupid because that's what the curse did to him.
Okay.
And it's not because he did anything bad. In the book, it's just like an evil fairy cursed me. He didn't say what he did.
Yeah. I mean, hey, in life, something bad stuff happens to you for no reason, but I prefer the morality in the movie of like, no, he was an asshole to somebody who wanted help. So that person then punished him for judging someone by how they look.
But if you also take apart the logic of the movie, he was 11.
Yes,
when he did that.
Yeah, that's also, yeah, who wasn't a jerk when they were 11? Come on.
His brain wasn't done developing.
Yeah.
Take me to evil witch court. So the beast ends up not killing Belle, and every day they have dinner together, and she's like repulsed by him, but he's very kind, and at the end of every meal, he asks Belle to marry him, and she says no, because it's like, this guy's ugly. Mm-hmm. He's really nice, but he's ugly, and I don't like him. And that's the mechanics of the story. So there's no Gaston. There's no unruly mob of townspeople. Huh. The brothers mention about going to the castle to kill the beast, but they end up not doing that.
Okay.
And the finale is much different. So like in the movie, Beast lets Beauty go home to see her father, right? In this case, her evil sisters trick her into staying longer. And because of that, the beast basically commits suicide in a long form way. He starts starving himself because he's so sad.
Oh, geez.
And then when Beauty returns to the castle to see him, she sees he's in this horrible state because he's so sad. And that's when, because he, you know, committed self-harm for so long, she fell in love with him. Not the best relationship.
Yeah, geez.
But,
you know, I turned you down to marry you, but now that I see that you hurt yourself when I'm not there,
yeah,
then I guess I'll have to marry you.
I guess it was the 18th century, but mm-hmm. when she sees the state he's in, she falls in love with him, and they, you know, she agrees to marry him, and that's when the curse is lifted. He becomes a beautiful prince, and then her sisters are turned into statues who have to watch her like happiness every day until they're sorry.
Jesus.
Yeah.
Well, that's a heavy price for those stepsisters to pay, man.
Yeah. But again, like Pinocchio, it's all about, hey, little kid, this is the kind of person you should be. And just like in Pinocchio, a big part of it is you have to take care of your elderly parents. So Belle is taken care of in the movie Maurice, in the book just her dad, because, I mean, even though this book was written, I think around the same time as Pinocchio, I forget, it's been a few months, but there's still not a big social safety net for the elderly. So, Belle is tasked with taking care of her father, and she doesn't mind at all, and you shouldn't either.
It's going to have to be your responsibility someday, so you better enjoy it. Yeah. So he still gets transformed by true love at the end, though, and he becomes, is he handsome at least?
I mean, there's no description, but I assume he's a similarly like fish-lipped blonde guy.
Okay, yeah. That guy is too, he's handsome enough, but yeah, this is a core conceit of the film.
On the commentary, they say, I don't think we could have done a better job with this guy. They're like, they don't like it either.
Nah, I mean, look, he's a Fabio looking dude. That's all he needs to be. Yeah.
So yeah, that's the original story. Please check it out. It's very, very easy to read. It's probably readable online. I didn't look, but the Penguin Books edition. If you want to read more sicko stories about animal husbands and, you know, brides, that's where you got to go, folks. And you may be put on a list for that. I probably already am.
Hey, it's classic literature. That's your cover for it.
It's classic pornography. So let's talk about the history of the movie Beauty and the Beast. So some brief facts about the movie first. Released in a limited way on November 13th, 1991. I believe November 22nd, 91 is the official release date worldwide, or at least America-wide. So it made $440 million on a $25 million budget.
Ooh, wowee.
And weirdly, it seems like this in Aladdin costs much less to make than The Little Mermaid, probably because the cap system helped streamline things for Disney. But with The Lion King onwards, the budgets would get massive, and that probably has a lot to do with the celebrity talent they're bringing on board.
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah, this has, I don't know, I don't think Jerry Orbach cost that much money.
No, he wasn't even on Law & Order yet.
Yeah.
Yes. He wasn't even Lenny Briscoe, is that his name?
Yeah, I guess Angela Lansbury would be the most famous person in this movie.
She's a superstar here with Murder, She Wrote. So, this is the first animated movie to be nominated for Best Picture at the Oscars. The other two are Up and Toy Story 3.
I mean, deserving, I'd say,
I don't know about Up.
Well, I guess both of those are in the post-2008-10 things get nominated era, right?
Yes, yes. That's the only reason why they're there. And, of course, we have the Kinda Bad Best Animated Feature category now. But, yeah, this snuck in. It lost to The Silence of the Lambs, and the other nominees were JFK, Boys in the Hood, Bugsy, and Thelma and Louise. All good and memorable, except for Bugsy.
Yeah, actually.
Who's talking about Bugsy?
Man, Bugsy, yeah. I completely forget the film Bugsy. But, yeah, unlike all of those other classic mafia movies, nobody talks about that. I could have seen Beauty and the Beast winning it, and, of course, as a little kid, I was watching that Oscars very closely because I had finally seen a Best Picture nominee. I never had before that because usually they were darker R-rated movies.
You could have, I guess you couldn't have seen Silence of the Lambs.
No.
Although I did see that on VHS when it came out and not Beauty and the Beast.
Wow, man. I don't think I saw Silence of the Lambs until like 96, 97 after again, enough references on The Simpsons made me go like, I should just watch this, or I guess really The Critic had the most fava beans references.
I need to know what Honey, I Ate the Kids is about. So it did win two Oscars. So Best Original Score by Alan Menken and Best Original Song, Beauty and the Beast.
I don't know if it's still true, but I believe Alan Menken is the man with at least living man with the most Oscars, thanks to all of his score wins on films like this.
I would
this.
Say probably living, I'm guessing. Mm-hmm. But yeah, very talented, of course. And so we just covered The Little Mermaid last month. Hopefully that's fresh in your mind because the history of this movie transitions nicely from the history of that movie because they are like, this is the next feature. I mean, yes, there's Rescuers Down Under, but that's a different story.
Yes, yeah, which we'll get into next month. But definitely from the limited research I've already done on Rescuers Down Under, that felt like more of the B project to this one. Like it was, when it released, the story in Waking Sleeping Beauty is when it released and didn't do that great, Katzenberg just said, well, you know, guys, hey, move on. We'll have another shot next year. And they just let it go. They weren't staking too much on it compared to this.
Not to spoil things for next month. Is that considered an official Disney feature or is it not like a Goofy movie isn't?
It is counted on the wiki pages for Disney Renaissance. Okay. And I think for the numbers, it does count as, I believe it is the 28th, and this is the 29th. It is not a Disney Toons one. It actually counts.
It looks really good. It looks much better than DuckTales.
Well, a lot of the best animators who worked on, like James Baxter, for instance, he worked on Rescuers and then moved right over to Beauty and the Beast. So, yeah, it had the A-team on it. It wasn't just a bunch of French people or people in Orlando. This was the real team.
What do French people know? Hey, they're pretty good. So, yes, this is just the continuation of that narrative. So, before we begin, one thing should be noted that when this film was released, Beauty and the Beast was very fresh in our cultural memory because there was a 3-season CBS show literally called Beauty and the Beast, starring Linda Hamilton and Ron Perlman. That was not like a massive mega hit, but it was like a Twin Peaks style phenomenon that was like, what is this weird show doing on TV? I've never seen anything like this. And it went away pretty quickly. Twin Peaks went away faster, but this one went away in 3 seasons. And also, George R.R. Martin wrote for it.
Oh, I didn't know that.
He wrote like 20% of its 50-ish episodes.
Wow, man.
So there you have it.
I only watched a couple episodes here and there, like on Sci-Fi Channel or whatever, because people would always talk it up as like, you know, this cult classic. But it never really clicked with me, even though I can totally see, you know, it's the two great actors. I love both of the Ron Perlman and Linda Hamilton, and to see them fall in love, and Ron Perlman, as he often has to do, like act under a shitload of ugly man makeup.
Yes. And I think he lived in the sewers or something.
I think so.
My mom was into this show.
Yeah. Hey, well, look, every generation does love a beautiful woman with a large beastly man. Mm-hmm. Like we all love that kind of story. Yes.
And one other thing, one of my favorite movies from just a year before this movie is Edward Scissorhands.
Oh yeah, yeah.
And that's another Beauty and the Beast, except the Beast comes home and stays in your house.
That's true. Yeah, it's very similar, except it's the Beast moves in,
and it's
yeah.
got its own Gaston and everything. So,
oh wow, yeah.
Yeah, and he yeah. dies kind of in the same way, although yeah, Edward does stab him in the heart. But
yeah. Oh, and I guess you know, Cogsworth and Vincent Price in it, they're kind of similar.
Yeah, yeah.
But that's funny, man. And well, did you also see the, I only watched it because it was on the Criterion thing, but the Beauty and the Beast Jean Cocteau version?
No, I'm going to get to that though.
Oh, okay, all right.
Yes.
Cool, cool.
And yes, the story is still popular today. The last adaptation was 2021's Belle by Mamoru Hosoda. And yes,
oh right, yeah, yeah.
In the comments, someone said, "Make sure you mention this." And there, I just mentioned it.
You did, you did.
You got zinged, pal.
I haven't seen that Hosoda film yet, but he also did that The Boy and His Beast movie too. Like the guy,
right.
The guy's into beast stuff,
yeah.
For sure.
He's kind of a furry, that guy.
Oh yeah, I mean, he got his big start on Digimon, which
right.
is furry adjacent as well. Yeah.
So yeah, that I mean, they're still doing this now, and in the history, as far as Disney is concerned, they tried to get Beauty and the Beast off the ground in the past. Mm-hmm. Even while Walt was still alive. So attempts were made to figure it out like in the 30s and the 50s, but they couldn't really crack the story. And of course, you know, the war happened. It kind of derailed all of their feature efforts. They had to make, you know, the package movies and everything like that. And then they just never could figure it out. And then in 1946, the Jean Cocteau movie comes out and it's sort of the definitive Beauty and the Beast. So Disney's like, they did it. And if we do it, it just will be compared to that.
Yeah, I didn't see it until the aughts when I was becoming a real snooty person who's like, well, if it's on Criterion Collection, I must watch it. That means it's good. And I say this having just bought several Criterion Blu-rays on the recent sale, but Hedwig and the Angry Inch right at the top. Going to watch that soon. But I watched it, and yeah, it rules. It's great. Like, it is gorgeous cinematography, amazing, like, realistic special effects, like magical realism. There's this bit of probably the most magical shot in the movie is Belle, or the Beauty, going through a hallway full of like the wind blowing, and it looks like she's walking, but actually if you look closely, she's like on a cart being pulled, so she's supposed to look like she's walking, but she's not actually moving her legs, and like candelabras or arms and stuff, and there's so many like magical effects in it.
Yeah,
it's really great.
It's a real like special effects tour de force for the 1940s. Mm-hmm. I really wanted to see it. I didn't get around to it for this, but it's on my list for sure.
Oh yeah,
it's
great. I don't think I have not seen any other Jean Cocteau films, so
same here.
Judge me for that, but I did like the one he made for children.
But until 1991, that was the definitive version of the movie. Mm-hmm. Sort of like with Hunchback, there were definitive Hollywood versions of that story until Disney made theirs. Mm-hmm. And who knows, maybe those black and white versions are more definitive still. And in the movie, they are drawing a lot from the Cocteau version, obviously.
It's funny with this and The Little Mermaid and a lot of others, it's like, this ancient storybook, Walt Disney tried to make it and he just couldn't figure it out. Like he never could get it working, and it took 30, 40 years for somebody else to finally put it all together.
I say too much canned chili.
You know, with that, all that canned chili, he's that probably put him in a beastly mood.
Spending all the time on the toilet. So let's fast forward to 1987, and this goes back to another one of our subjects, Who Framed Roger Rabbit. So during the production of Who Framed Roger Rabbit, the Disney company decides to resurrect this Beauty and the Beast idea. And who better to direct it than the legendary Richard Williams?
Son of a bitch,
yes.
Really? Wow.
Yes,
wow.
And guess what? You can guess this, Henry. He turns it down because he's like, guys, fuck the Beauty and the Beast. Thief and the Cobbler.
Yeah, Thief and the Cobbler. That's the next mega hit. I'm going to make it so good, guys.
It's like, it's a movie about a thing and another thing, and it's going to knock your socks off. But he's like, yeah, I'm not going to do that for you guys. But he does recommend a colleague, Richard Purdom. So I want to say that Richard Purdom worked on mostly commercials because his IMDb credits are extremely limited. Mm-hmm. So I have to assume he was doing a ton of commercials with Richard Williams at his studio. But his studio, the Richard Purdom studio, did work on things like Hercules and Fantasia 2000. So they outsourced things to him. So originally, this was going to be a UK production, this movie.
Yeah, you know, from your Purdom, I don't recall him from my Roger Rabbit research, but definitely his resume sounds like the type of guy who worked with Richard Williams a lot, meaning a coworker who finished projects for Richard Williams
yes.
and eventually quit working with Richard Williams.
Yeah, he made his own studio. Mm-hmm. So Purdom, I believe at this point it is still a UK production. He starts working under producer Don Hahn.
Yeah, Don Hahn, he must have, I believe it was from doing the Roger Rabbit research that after they shipped out Roger Rabbit, Don Hahn just stuck around England working on this. Yeah.
And this is going to be a non-musical version of the Beauty and the Beast story.
Mm.
And due to Michael Eisner's insistence, this is the first Disney animated feature to start with a screenplay. With Aladdin and other movies, they would sometimes come in after the fact, especially when Aladdin was like rescued, right, by two screenwriters.
Right.
But
right.
this is the first time they started with a screenplay.
Wow. Yeah, because Little Mermaid, I recall that Katzenberg wanted to hire screenwriters. Musker and Clements were able to convince him to let them write the script, and he just accepted the script as worthy. But yeah, this sounds like a very Hollywood thing of like, now this is like the fifth animated feature Eisner's been in charge of. I can see at this point he's like, no, let's start with a screenplay. We're going to do this. I don't care how you cartoon boys do with your story pitch meetings and everything. I want a script first.
We're doing this the Hollywood way.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I saw that Oliver and Company had screenwriters attached. I have to assume they came in after the fact as well.
Yeah, I would think so, yeah. Well, I mean, that also, I'm sure we'll learn more about it when we finally do it as a podcast, but that one also had a major reset because I know that multiple people, including Andreas Deja, quit that film to move over to Roger Rabbit because they were pissed off that it had like a big reset that threw out a lot of their work.
I'm so curious. That one is very, very Katzenberg-y.
Mm-hmm. Oh, my God. Yes. I mean, it's Shrek before Shrek. Like the star-studdedness of it. It's so Shrek-y. But just replace...
Bette Midler? Is Bette Midler in that movie?
Bette Midler is, but I was thinking it's Billy Joel instead of the... Smash Mouth.
Difference. Hey, yeah. Better movie.
I think so.
So they hire Linda Wolverton to write the screenplay, and it's weird they hired her because, or maybe it makes sense, but she was mostly associated with typically bad Saturday morning cartoons.
Mm.
Maybe a few good ones in there too. So she wrote for things like The Popples, Ewoks, the unaired Garbage Pail Kids cartoon.
Oh,
she wrote a real Ghostbusters episode and also Dennis the Menace. So. Huh. Those were the things she worked on before working for Beauty and the Beast. And that was really where her career went in a more like prestige direction, let's say.
That's interesting that transitioned her into prestige because, yeah, I know like with all that Roger Rabbit 2 research I did, that Katzenberg was really into getting people who had already done like real adult work, as in not working on stuff for kids, and then bringing them on to this kids production, like the main writer of Roger Rabbit 2 that I talked about, he had worked on Barney Miller and other nighttime sitcoms and was getting into animation instead. It almost seems completely the opposite of how Disney usually goes of uplifting a Saturday morning writer with such a big offer as this one.
Yeah, I don't know the circumstances behind her hiring, but it is surprising. But you know what? She continued her relationship with Disney. She did story development on Aladdin and Mulan. She co-wrote The Lion King. She wrote Homeward Bound, The Incredible Journey, and she is also the writer of one of the most garbage but profitable movies of all time, 2010's Alice in Wonderland.
Holy shit.
That was her pitch and her screenplay.
Holy cow, man. Yeah. She's got to be so rich from that one.
And she's also behind the Maleficent movies, and she's attached to the third film that's upcoming as of this recording.
God damn it. Yeah, that's been the fucking, you know, Alice in Wonderland might be one of the most destructive films ever in film history of like, all of the shit that followed it, man.
It made Sam Raimi do a bad movie, too.
It made him do a terrible Oz movie. It made all of the incredibly popular and empty live-action remakes that we've seen. Yeah, it's sad.
So she also adapted this movie into a Broadway version and won her a Tony. So,
man, she's close to an EGOT then, I'd say.
Yeah, getting there. Let's see. Maybe one of her Garbage Pail Kids could win a posthumous Emmy. Not past her death, but past the death of the show. I got to see what that cartoon is. I don't think we'll ever sink that low. Yeah, I don't know. We did Laverne and Shirley in the Army.
Yeah, I'd say Garbage Pail Kids is more popular than Laverne and Shirley in the Army.
It's got to be more quality. Let's talk about a Garbage Pail adult, Jeffrey Katzenberg.
Yeah.
So this version is coming into being, the Purdom and Wolverton version. And he sees the initial story reels for it in 1989, and he scraps everything. He's like, this sucks. Do it again. Start from scratch. I want a better idea. So this causes Purdum to resign. He's out.
Dang, man. I mean, I remember seeing some of those story reels in Waking Sleeping Beauty, and it could just be what they chose to show, but it did look kind of boring and a little flat.
Yeah.
You know? Which I guess, too, if you're going to insist on no musicals, then you're already inviting a lifelessness to your kid's film, you know?
Yeah, I don't know how it would have turned out, but I don't think it would have turned out better than this.
No.
So who does Katzenberg turn to but Musker and Clements?
Oh.
This is 1989, so either Little Mermaid was about to wrap or had just wrapped, and you know, rightfully so, they were like, we're very tired. we don't want to direct another movie right now, and yes, they don't until Aladdin.
Yeah.
So, yeah, they're taking a little bit of time to, you know, regroup and, you know, get their stamina back. And this is where Kirk Wise and Gary Trousdale come in. I didn't do a bio on them for Hunchback because I was saving it for this.
Oh boy. All right.
So we don't know at this point where they came from until now, unless you already looked it up yourself. So I think they're the secret MVPs of the Disney Renaissance because they direct this movie, which is like the Best Picture nom, and also Hunchback, which should have been a Best Picture nom, mm-hmm. and is my favorite movie of the Disney Renaissance that pushed things so far, and I'm so sad they pulled it back. Go back to our podcast from last year. I love that movie so much. Mm-hmm. But yeah, this is where they enter the picture.
Definitely of those two films, like they have the most mature sensibility of them. Not that their movies don't also have stuff for the kids of silly action and all that, but I think they deal in more, in both Beauty and the Beast and Hunchback, they deal with more French and
very
mature
French
settings. Yeah.
Yeah, and it's like they have a similar trajectory to Musker and Clements because they make these big hits. Musker and Clements make Treasure Planet. They make Atlantis.
Oh, man.
They each have their own early aughts megabomb.
They were both cursed with the early aughts megabomb. As you blame Shrek and Toy Story for making 2D die, you know, that's the sad bit. That's the sad news of it.
And I really want to revisit those like Treasure Planet, Home on the Range, Atlantis. I want to see what's going on there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I bet what we'd find is some very great character animation, even if it's like kind of disappointing as far as a full story goes.
So astoundingly, this is their very first feature. And apparently Katzenberg was very impressed by their animation work on an Epcot ride called Cranium Command.
What?
Have you ever been on Cranium Command?
It closed. Okay. I don't think so.
It's an 89 attraction. It closed in 2007. This basically is a ride that teaches you about the brain.
No, I don't think I rode that. I went to Epcot during that era of it, and I feel like I would have ridden it if I could. I went on a class field trip to Epcot in 96, I think it was. And at that time, I was most excited by that they had the Sega area where you could like unreleased games or soon to release games.
That's educational.
and Body Wars was freaking closed, so I couldn't even ride that.
This is a lesser Body Wars, but you can go online and watch a ride through. What they did was the pre-ride movie in which this drill sergeant is yelling facts about the brain at you, and that is their work. Wow. So a funny story behind this, Rob Minkoff was supposed to direct that segment, but he had to drop out to direct Roller Coaster Rabbit. It's all connected.
Wow.
It's all connected. Wow. And apparently this pre-show thing was the final animation to be produced on cells by Walt Disney Feature Animation. The final thing they ever did on cells before Caps.
Yeah. That's so cool.
After Little Mermaid, apparently. Apparently at this time, Trousdale and Wise were developing a project known as Goofy of the Apes, which I assume was one of many attempts to give Goofy a TV show that eventually led to Goof Troop. Wow. Go back to our Goof Troop project. You can see that Goof Troop is like the end result of like 8 different pitches for Goofy.
Wow, I had never heard of Goofy of the Apes. That's crazy.
I don't know if it would have been good, but that's what they were developing. And they're like, get off the Apes project. You're on Cranium Command. And then apparently that impressed Iser so much that it's like, you guys can direct Beauty and the Beast.
Wow.
So they were fairly young when starting this project. Trousdale was in his late 20s and Wise was in his mid 20s. And it seems like they both entered Walt Disney Feature Animation around the same time. Trousdale started with The Black Cauldron and Wise started with The Great Mouse Detective. And it seems like Katzenberg was willing to give these guys a chance because there was a screenwriter laying out the groundwork for them. So it's like, you guys know how to animate. There's already going to be a story laid out for you. This is going to be fine.
Guys in their mid-20s, like one in their mid-20s, the other in their late 20s, getting that kind of opportunity now from Disney on their biggest projects like that. That does not sound like something they would do these days.
I feel like you don't even get a TV show until you're in your 30s at Disney.
Yeah, pretty much.
Or maybe late 20s, but yeah.
Unless you're a guy who worked on Saturday Night Live, then they do give you your own movie.
That is true.
Yeah.
But yeah, this might not surprise you. Trousdale and Wise went to CalArts.
Of course.
They met in 81. they started working together in the story department of Oliver and Company, and then were assigned to work on the story department of The Rescuers Down Under.
Man, if you were in CalArts a little before we were born, you probably directed most things. You worked on at least one major Disney project.
Yeah, I wonder if the CalArts guys have like the Disney pipeline still. Mm. Is it still going on like that?
Yeah, I don't know. You know, the last time we hear about CalArts was like 6 years ago, complaining about how all the Nickelodeon and Disney shows look like a certain Cal art style.
Oh, right, right.
But yeah, I don't know if the top dudes and gals creating animation now, I don't know if it's as much of the Cal arts thing, especially because that Cal arts thing also, the negative assumptions about it too, is thrown at people who like Adventure Time was created by Pendleton Ward, not a CalArts graduate.
Right, right.
You've got Rebecca Sugar, Andy, and Joe's Cordy, our pals, both of whom learned and graduated from art schools on the East Coast. They were not CalArts people. CalArts is just used as an overall term of to mean a negative towards a specific.
Those rotten bean mouths.
Yes, yeah.
Oh, I hate them. I'm just kidding.
But yeah, but the old CalArts thing just meant you were pretty much already going to be interning at Disney once it was over. Yeah.
There was a real pipeline. So yeah, they meet in 81. They first start working together on Oliver and Company, and they were pulled off the Rescuers Down Under to work on, again, Roger Rabbit stuff.
Wow.
So, yes, Trousdale and Wise working on Rescuers Down Under. They're like, we need Roger Rabbit shorts ideas. And these two guys fully storyboarded an unmade short called Baby Buggy Blunder.
Whoa.
And in this short, Roger loses control of Baby Herman's carriage in a busy city.
Oh, man.
This short was fully storyboarded by them.
Holy cow.
Yeah.
I'm embarrassed that didn't come up in all my Roger Short search material.
This just came out of like a random interview with them.
Wow.
Just like there is so much Roger Rabbit material has been lost.
Man. You know, it definitely sounded like that you would finish your entire storyboard and then it would either be approved or not approved by Spielberg. So maybe it didn't get final approval from Spielberg. But there was also that, you know, the thinking was maybe Spielberg got so mad about the arachnophobia Dick Tracy thing that he might have just withheld approval on any new shorts out of like punishment to Jeffrey Katzenberg.
That's what it sounds like. But yeah, they wasted time on that. So yeah, Roger Rabbit, it's all over this history here.
Yeah.
So yeah, back to the production of the movie. We did our Trousdale and Wise history. Let's talk about the production of the movie. So things get very sad here, unfortunately, because Howard Ashman was at the end of his battle with the AIDS virus.
Yes.
And he is pulled off of his pet project, Aladdin, to work on this ailing film. Because go back to our Aladdin podcast, I'm sure we talked about it. That was his baby. Mm-hmm. He was obsessed with Aladdin. He is removed from that project because Beauty and the Beast needs help and only he can save it.
Right. And they're going to take something that was not a musical and turn it into a musical. So this is a huge ask on his part. And yes, the Howard doc on the Disney Plus documentary shows, like he's dying. Like he's not doing good. He's sick and getting sicker. And it's, I feel looking back on it to, you know, what seems like a small ask or not too small, but like, hey, come on, just work on Beauty and the Beast as well. You're asking someone to give up the last year of their life.
Yeah.
But it turns out to be, I'm sure they weren't thinking that when they did it, but you're asking him to give up the last year of his entire life on this thing.
And he would eventually die on March 14th, 91. So well before the movie came out, he was able to see an unfinished version of it, thankfully, before he passed. But yeah, he did not live to see the release of the movie. And it's interesting that, I'm glad that they have a dedication to him at the end of this movie. I'm not sure if it was made public that's what happened to him, but in November of 91, this releases, and also we get the Magic Johnson HIV announcement.
Right.
So AIDS is very in the news, in the mainstream, not just something that happens to gay people.
Right.
It's like, quote unquote, normal people can get it. So that's what the Magic Johnson thing taught a lot of ignorant people.
Boy, you know, yeah, the timing of that, you know, Ashman dying in March, certainly it was, and also the film Philadelphia is coming soon
as
well.
Yeah.
And but in all those cases, like, it is that AIDS finally found good victims or one.
Yeah.
Like, honestly, to market it to people should have cared about AIDS for a long time since it began. But obviously through the 80s, they did not, because it didn't. It seemed to only be affecting gay men and who deserved it for the wages of their sin. But by 1991, it was starting to get more mainstream. And it's interesting to see, you know, the crossroads that Disney was at, because when Ashman dies, you know, they let people know. It was public knowledge that he had died of AIDS, but they didn't advertise it. But if you watch, it's featured in the doc, so that's why it's at the front of my mind. When Ashman wins the posthumous Oscar for Beauty and the Beast, it is his partner, like, basically husband, but legally wasn't right. His husband. His husband accepts the award, and everybody at that show has on their AIDS ribbon, and he's like, I was Howard's partner for X amount of years, and I'm so happy, but this is also, you know, sad. He's the first person ever to win an Oscar who died of AIDS. Like,
yeah. I did not watch the Howard doc because I didn't want to be sad.
It'll make you too sad.
I eventually want to watch it because you and I just recently saw Little Shop of Horrors in a theater.
Yeah.
Not the movie, but a performance of it. I saw it twice, and I'm just thinking constantly about that musical when I'm watching Beauty and the Beast, because I see a lot of things in common that aren't in The Little Mermaid, because Howard Ashman has given a lot of control over this movie. Because he's dying.
Yes.
They let him basically do whatever he wants, and that includes moving the production, pre-production to, I believe, the city is called Fishkill, New York.
Yes, yeah.
So at a certain point, he's able to work out of like a residence in there, but eventually he has to work out of his bedroom because he can't leave his bed. So
They're
being extremely accommodating. Like, Mencken is there, Trousdale, Wise, and Wolverton are all there, and they're all reworking the story into the one we know today. So that's all done there. The reason why this movie is full of Broadway stars is because they're casting in New York.
Ah, okay.
That's why there are no real celebrities in this movie. Like,
that's
the reason,
for the better, I think.
The reason that Jerry Orbach is in the movie is because he was a New York actor. That's why he's in Law and Order.
He's the greatest. Yeah. I love him in this. Yeah, in the Howard doc, first off, that home they were working on, this is another of the tragic things from it, that, like, his partner was an architect, so he was like, I'm going to build us our dream home. This is where we're going to live together. He finishes the home right as Howard's dying. I don't believe his partner is HIV positive, or at the very least, he seems fine.
I heard that he is not.
But on top of that, in the doc as well, they mentioned that a lot of the cartoon boys in Burbank or Glendale weren't aware of his. They were, you know, obviously they're not going to out him as HIV positive to everybody. But as far as the animators thought, at first they're like, oh, Mr. Fancy Pants, after he wins his Oscar, now he wants us all to fly to New York and make the movie at his place. He can't come to us. Whoop-de-doo.
And he's not just, you know, helping them craft the story. He's also mentoring Trousdale and Wise. This is all new to them. He's teaching them, here's how you direct people. Like, they didn't know how to do this. They're busy working on cranium command.
Oh, yeah. I guess you're not really directing actors that much in that way. Yeah.
So, like, he had to teach them how to do that. And apparently, Wolverton's first version of the story only focused on the two titular characters, because if you read the original story, there's really not many, like, much more outside of the two. So Ashman adds things like the Enchanted Castle friends. They draw upon the Cocteau version by adding the villain with Gaston. And they just really figure things out in this pre-production stuff. And like I said before, Ashman was too sick to leave his bed, so they basically set up a way for him, like pre-Skype, to direct actors from his home.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
That he could, I guess, you know, Disney's got all that money, they could figure it out, but in the you have to actually set up satellites for that kind of thing.
Yeah, it was complicated in like 1990 or whenever they were doing this, but like Mencken points out on the commentary for this film is great. It's Mencken, it's Trousdale, it's Wise, and it's Don Hahn, and they're telling all kinds of really funny stories, and it's on the DVD, so check that out. I used all that for a lot of my research, but
that's awesome.
On the commentary, Mencken's like, this was a line reading that Howard changed from his bed, like whispering into a microphone.
Holy cow. You can hear him a late recording in his life, just to see how sickly he was at the time. I this was something too in the book, in the movie, the Howard doc, that some of his coworkers on the film read into it, but his sister actually said, like, nah, I don't think so, which is that the ticking clock on the Beast and the fact that he's locked in a castle, like people who worked with him are like, oh, that sounds kind of like his situation while making the film. But the Beast's countdown to die and his affliction, his sister didn't seem to think that that was pulled from his HIV positive
status.
It's
a pretty broad idea, but I could see even like subconsciously working that in, you know, if you're living through that. And, you know, his sickness might have influenced the writing of certain songs, or at least the performance, because when Angela Lansbury was brought in to sing Beauty and the Beast, she had received Alan Menken's demo, and he was singing like this very powerful ballad style version. And she's like, I can't do this. This is not how I sing. And Menken was like, oh, shit, she got the wrong demo. So they gave her Howard's demo. And Howard, recording his demo very sick, is doing the kind of talk singing of Beauty and the Beast.
Wow.
So I think just being sick and having to record the song, that is why Beauty and the Beast sounds the way it does.
Oh, that's amazing, yeah. Man. I love her rendition of Beauty and the Beast. Again, the original song, Oscars that year, 3 of the 5 nominees were from Beauty and the Beast. Yeah,
and she did that in one take.
In one? Wow. Yeah.
She's
wow.
a pro, everybody.
I mean, yeah, she's, knock on wood, living legend, yeah. Angela Lansbury.
Broadway, TV, she's all over the place.
She's
movies.
Done it all.
So, yeah, because of all this pre-production nonsense, in terms of like initially getting the movie off the ground and then having to scrap it, this movie had a very rushed schedule. So normally at this time they were given a 3 or 4 year production cycle to make the movie. This time they had 2.
Wow. And from first time feature directors, like,
yes,
that's incredible that this ended up any good at all, let alone as good as it is.
They were really struggling against adversity. And on the commentary, they're very jokey. Like, yes, this shot doesn't make sense. This story doesn't make sense here. We realized we made mistakes. We had no time to look back at our own work. We were just trying to get as much footage as we can out and make it look good. So that's why the 2017 version, which I guess we could talk about briefly, it stinks, because it's like, well, the movie has all these errors we need to fix and address.
Yeah.
And I mean, you don't need me to tell you this. Watch Lindsay Ellis's video on the movie. It's perfect.
Thanks, I Hate It, I believe it's called. Yeah.
It is perfect. And I watched like half an hour and I couldn't stand anymore. But there are so many things that are added to the movie that are unnecessary and like trying to be progressive but feel just very forced and, you know, insincere. Like in the movie, it's a big deal. Like, Bella's teaching children how to read? That's illegal. When
yes.
Beauty and the Beast is a story written by a woman for little girls of that time period.
For little girls to read.
Yeah.
That's
women were literate. Women were writing.
Yeah, it sounded like in the they took the little bit in here of Gaston being old-fashioned. Gaston LeFou, I guess, being old-fashioned. But like, a girl reading? What? That's dumb.
Yeah.
And just had it be, oh, most people agree with Gaston and thinks it's dumb for a girl to read. Well, and also, I base this also just on that Lindsay Ellis video, because I didn't watch the full live action film, but it also sounded like they wanted to answer questions like, is every disembodied thing in there, is every plate a person, is every fork a person? Like, relax.
Yeah, let's calm down, everybody. It's it's ugly. Emma Watson, a beautiful woman, very miscast in that role.
No, I don't want to be mean to, I think Emma Watson is a lovely young woman who's also, I've seen her in stuff, I think she does a very good job acting. Like, she's in, I just saw that, not just 3 years ago, the Little Women movie. She's very good in that. But I don't think she's a great singer. From the clips of her songs, I'm like,
she looks uncomfortable.
Yeah, it's too bad. I guess I don't know who else you'd cast in that to be a mousy young would-be princess. Like, and also the bookishness, I suppose, fits with the character she's most famous for playing, Hermione Granger.
Right. But they also just announced another adaptation, but it's going to be like the Little Mermaid thing, where it's like you watch the movie, but when there's a song, there's like a concert version of it.
Yeah, boy. I watched that little, I hope it's better than the Little Mermaid one. The Little Mermaid one is kind of fun, but it also is just like, boy, some people are trying harder than others,
yeah.
And it just feels kind of flat. I don't know. John Stamos was having a good time.
Yeah.
And I think Queen Latifah was too, but she actually, like, she flubs a couple lines, which honestly makes me like it more, because I'm like, oh, they actually didn't retake this line. They just kept her having the flub in
it. It was all one take. Mm. So there's a really rushed production cycle for this movie. Because of that, 10 minutes are outsourced to their newer Florida division.
Yes.
And that includes the Be Our Guest segment. That's animated in Florida.
Man, that has the Florida feel to it, just like I Can't Wait to Be King in 94's Lion King.
It's like the fun party song with lots of colors is animated in Florida.
Oh, man. I guess was Chris Sanders brought all the colors to that in the, or was a big part of that in Lion King. I wonder if he was involved in BRS.
He's a big part of this movie, and we'll talk more about that soon. Got the less notable Rescuers Down Under is actually the first all-digital Disney feature film, and this one takes advantage of that with a few shots that were astounding at the time and hold up incredibly well today. So they knew they had the power of computers, and Disney, of course, had been using computers to figure out certain things before this. We talked about it with previous movies. But, you know, technology was advancing, and Trousdale and Wise were like, what can we do with this technology? So they at first thought, like, let's make the whole forest around the Beast Castle CGI, like a CGI backdrop. Mm-hmm. How can we do that? And they explain on the commentary that after 3 months, the team had rendered basically one tree that looked like a chicken foot. And they were like, we can't do anything organic with this technology yet, because it was like the late 80s, very early 90s.
Wow. But, well, I guess they did discover, like, a plate or a glass can look pretty good in 3D and just bounce around. Yeah,
basically, yeah. Like, the simpler, the better. And what can also look good in 3D is a room, which is, the infamous shot. So Roger Allers, Brenda Chapman, a genius.
Oh, yeah.
Her name is like, associated with everything.
Mm-hmm,
and she was taken off of Brave. Not fair.
No, but, I feel like, man, that's another one we're going to have to do someday. But poor Brenda Chapman. She's like a key story, a high-level story person, at the very least, on most of the Disney stuff we talk about.
She's a genius, and she deserved better. But, yeah, Roger Allers and Brenda Chapman were, like, they pitched this idea to the directors. Like, what if we just do, like, one shot, and here's how we can figure it out? And Trousdale and Wise were very receptive. Like, hey, yeah, let's figure this out. And, yes, that is, even though James Baxter was just assigned to Belle, he is doing both of those characters dancing because they say on the commentary he was born with, like, an extra part of his brain that lets him, like, figure out how to rotate characters perfectly.
It's insane.
Yeah, he's, like, got, like, a perspective camera in his brain or something that figures all this out. But that, just him doing all of that footage.
That's, I mean, yeah, it is amazing. It's incredible, that shot. Like, that was the shot that it gives me goosebumps every time I see it. Like, that's probably why I wanted to see Newsies again in the theater, just to see that dance sequence. Like, there's just something so beautiful and magical about it. Like, that we've, and we'll talk about it in depth when we get to it in the movie. But yeah, it's, like, so good. It's that, again, I'll bring them up again. Rebecca Sugar, our pal, you know, she grew up loving these films too, and especially the James Baxter dance sequence. And James Baxter, as she became a professional herself, she became a colleague of his and worked with him on stuff. And she did a favor for him because I believe it was one of his kids was a big Steven Universe fan. And he says, hey, I owe you a favor. And she called in that favor for the finale episode of regular Steven Universe.
Right.
Where there is a, if you haven't seen it yet, I won't spoil it, but there is a dance sequence staged somewhat similar to this, but it's meant to be like, this is our James Baxter dance sequence, and it's just as important as it was in Beauty and the Beast.
I have seen it, and it's totally James Baxter, and he was chosen for this because they were like, you worked on Roger Rabbit. Mm-hmm. You were moving these characters as if a camera was moving around them. Like, you know perspective. You know how this works. But they weren't sure if they could render the shot in time. It was still very early, and they weren't sure how well the CGI would look. So they had a plan for this. Their plan was, if the computer stuff is not finished or doesn't work, we will turn off that layer and have Beauty and the Beast dancing in a void with a spotlight on them.
Oh.
So it would be just like, they call it an ice capades shot.
Oh,
so,
that's, you know, that would have worked.
Yeah.
That would have worked. It wouldn't be half as memorable, but it would have worked for sure.
Definitely, yeah. But that, yeah, it's interesting to see, like, as the power of CGI grew, Disney was very careful how to use it. It's like one little shot here, one little touch there, until they're actually making, you know, CG movies.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, you know, that they could tell how lifeless some things looked and how haunted they were. It was smart of Disney and other people like that to recognize the limitations of CGI, because once it got more sprawled out and everybody could do it, people were just doing such lifeless, crappy CGI.
Yeah.
Because, like, just because you can do something doesn't mean you should.
They recognized the power of character animation, and until the computers got advanced enough, they couldn't replace 2D with that animation.
And until the best animators actually learned how to move characters in CGI also.
I have not seen Chicken Little. That's the first one. I did see Meet the Robinsons. Didn't like it at all. People have a soft spot for that one. But I mean, we'll cover the early era of Disney CGI. It's a bit weird. It's a bit up and down.
I think by Wreck-It Ralph, they definitely figured it out. Yeah. And Frozen has good character animation in it too.
Yeah, it took about like 4 or 5 years. Haven't seen Bolt either.
Oh, yes, right. Yeah, it's too depressing to know that, like, the Hollywood dog turned into that, right?
Yeah, that's true.